You're listening to the Next Flight to Spain podcast. Join me for conversations with my favorite chefs, olive oil makers, educators, wine experts, Spain aficionados, and friends. We'll discuss fresh ideas for enjoying Spain on your next trip. Welcome to the Next Flight to Spain. We're so glad you're here. My special guest today is Sergio Azcona, who goes by Sasha. Welcome, Sasha.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Thank you for joining me today. I'd like to tell our listeners a little bit about Sasha before we begin. Sasha is an author, a communications professor at the University of Complutense, Madrid. He has his own communications consultancy and is director of the Azcona Foundation, which is a Spanish nonprofit organization that promotes art and culture, specifically artistic creation and scientific research. Sasha has written several books, including lovely children's books inspired by bedtime stories for his children, and we'll talk about those a little later. What inspired me to invite Sasha to join us here is his love for the work of Spanish film director Pedro Almodóvar. If you are an admirer of Almodóvar's work, you'll want to pick up a copy of Sasha's book, El Madrid de Pedro Almodóvar, which includes interviews with Almodóvar and is a guide to his iconic film locations throughout the city of Madrid. Sasha, for those of us who are not familiar with Pedro Almodóvar, can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Well, it's hard not to know Pedro Almodóvar, but he's a celebrated Spanish filmmaker. He's world-known, he's won an Oscar, and he has a very personal style, which is marked by humor that challenges social norms, lots of drama, bold color, and he likes to work with really strong and important actors like Penelope Cruz, Antonio Banderas, Javier Bardem, to name a few known by everybody. He started to be known with the film Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, which won him a nomination, an Oscar nomination. And then he's very well known for All About My Mother, Talk to Her, Pain and Glory, Volver. So there's many films, and he just made a film with Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal. So now working with Hollywood actors, and he's starting to get really, really well known.
Absolutely. I have not seen that film yet. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's not on streaming yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too.
Sasha, your personal experience with Almodóvar is very interesting. I read that you worked with him as a screenwriter at one time. Is that true?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. So
I haven't.
It's so funny because when I saw that, I did some research on you and I saw that. I thought, I wonder if this is one of those things that is sort of mistranslated.
Well, maybe. Well, there's a really funny story. When I was 19 years old, I dreamt of being a screenwriter. So I wrote this horrendous screenplay with a friend of mine. And, you know, we were 18, 19 years old. We thought life was filled with rainbows and unicorns and everything was easy. So we did what we thought was the logical thing to do, which was give Almodóvar our screenplay, you know, just because we thought that was going to be the thing. I'm 48 now, and I was, as they say, 18, 19 years old. So we showed up at his office, you know, with no anticipation and nothing. We just knocked on the door, and his secretary opened. He was not there. Uh-huh. And we said, well, we have this screenplay. She looked at us, like, saying, what the heck is going on here? Uh-huh. And we turned him the screenplay. He, of course, he never phoned back. But thing is that before that happened, his office was on a ground level, but we misunderstood the address and we went to the basement. We thought that the ground was a basement. So we went to the basement where all the trash was, you know, the trash cans of the building were. Mm-hmm. And so we started looking for the office and we saw some boxes that said Pedro Almodóvar where his trash was. So we started looking, and going through his garbage, and there were some scripts and some letters from fans. And so I remember, and I'm sorry to say that we picked up a script that he had thrown that he signed. I have no idea what it is now, but yeah, all his trash was there for anyone to pick it up. And then we went and gave him our screenplay, and of course, he never called back. That's as close as I've been to him.
So technically, you wrote a play and gave it to Pedro Almodóvar.
Yeah, well, I gave it to his secretary. Yeah,
just his secretary.
I did. And well, and then when I went to see this movie by Martin Scorsese, it's not The Departed. It's it's Leonardo DiCaprio being in some kind of health institution or mental institution.
Okay.
I was sitting alone in the cinema, and he sat next to me. And that's happened to me twice. He sat twice next to me in the cinema. I swear it, this has happened to me. And I never had the courage to say, hey, I've written this book about you. I never did. But I have spoken with Agustin, who's his brother and who produces all his movies. I've talked to him over on Twitter. We've emailed each other a lot, and he's given me some support on the book. Yeah, but I've never had the courage to tell him a lover that I have this book about you. I never did. I don't know.
How do you know he doesn't love it and use it with his friends? I mean, you've done so much work. First of all, let's talk just briefly. What led you to write El Madrid de Pedro Almodóvar? What led you to do that?
Well, I was watching a movie, and then I said, wow, this place looks awesome. Where is this place? So it was a jello cinema, you know, it's like covered in some sort of plastic yellow walls, some really tacky, really modern thing, which was in Valencia, I later found out. And so I just Googled, you know, where is this same thing in place? I was at home watching the TV. And then I saw there were thousands of people asking where that scene was shot and asking where other scenes were shot. And I thought to myself, well, it's not that difficult because Almodóvar has always been shooting downtown Madrid. And I've lived in downtown Madrid all my life. So I know 99% of the places because I've lived there. So I said, well, why not write a book for all those thousands of people who are wondering where those scenes were shot? And that's it. So I did it, as simple as that. And to me, it was quite simple. You know, it was hard sometimes, you know, because he tends to change the street names. He changed even the street signs, and he covers them. So as not to tell a story on a specific street. He doesn't want to be the street Paseo de la Castellana. You know, he just gives it another name, and he creates a parallel universe, which is quite interesting, you know. And so sometimes it's hard, but, you know, with the help of Google and the help of some friends, I managed to find out everything.
So how do you know he doesn't have this book and he just loves it? Because it's such a great study of his films. And I would imagine that I imagine he's probably seen it. We should find out.
I think he's seen it. At least his brother has seen it.
Yeah.
The good thing about the guide, which I'd like to share with your listeners, is that it's not the typical guide, as you have these Hollywood guides that say, this scene was shot here, or the French TV show building was shot here, or the Godfather movie was shot here.
Yeah.
Because I thought that it was useless to do so with us having Google. I mean, why are you going to buy a book if you have the answer when you Google it? But what I thought was, hey, Madrid is structured around neighborhoods. You know, you have Chueca, which is downtown. Then you have Malasaña. And people sort of, quote, belong to their neighborhood. You know, they like their barrio.
Yeah.
And people love their barrio and love their restaurant and their bookstore. They're very barrio-like. That's how Madrid works. So what I did was, why don't I structure everything around barrios?
Mm-hmm.
So when you visit Madrid, you're walking around, I don't know, 5-6 blocks, and I not only tell you where a scene was shot, but I tell you where to eat the best tapas, the best tortilla de patata, the best sangria, where's the best flamenco show. Uh-huh. You know, that's the fun of it. Because if you want to know where something was shot, you just Google it as I'm saying it. So that's what I did. I just told my Madrid. The truth is that Almodóvar's Madrid is my Madrid. It's the places I love to go to, the small corners that no one goes, the places that the tourist guides don't tell you about.
Yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful book, and we'll get into it a little bit more. What I wanted to continue on with is, what do you feel are the central themes of Almodóvar's work?
Well, truth is, I'm not a scholar on his films, but I'd say love and deceit are the central themes always, you know, losing love and loneliness upon with his mother, which is the purest love of all, I believe. And what all the movies are always revolving on.
I think you've captured his central themes well, love and deceit, and especially secrets are central themes. I love sometimes he'll end a movie with a secret that makes you think, is this going to be another film?
Yeah.
he'll end it that way. And you're like, are you kidding me? You ended it right there.
Yeah.
I agree with you about his emphasis on motherhood. And for me, I think he portrays motherhood exceptionally well throughout his work, all the different aspects of it. And then my other thought was, one of the things that is a central theme for him that a lot of people don't talk about is honesty and being honest about what real life looks like in Madrid, but also across families. Yeah. I think it's a theme of what is it truly like to be part of a family? What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, and he explores so many different aspects of it. Again, starting with motherhood. It's an incredible body of work. And I think once people get into it, it's sort of addictive.
Yeah, it is. And you just talked about the truth and the beauty. He really likes to portray Madrid, how it really is.
Yeah.
It's not that idyllic Manhattan that we see in Sex and the City, for example, or in Woody Allen movies, you know, with middle-class people living in $5 million homes. You know, that's not real. That's a movie, which is great,
Right.
But Almodóvar shows you the homes that humble people live in. And so that's what I also like about his movies, that you get to see everything and it's a movie and you get to fantasize and to dream, but you also get to see the truth, which allows you to connect even more with the feelings and which gives you a touch of truth, so to say.
Definitely. When I watch his films, you just get completely immersed and you can actually really feel and imagine being there with the characters at the dining room table or standing there on the side of a terrace, or it has almost like a grit to it that feels very pure. You know, it's kind of tricky to explain, but you're right. When we watch Hollywood films, a lot of times they are very glossy and you don't always get that feeling that you're there with the characters the way that you do with Pedro Almodóvar's films.
Yeah.
On that, why do you think people love him so much in general? What are the elements of his films that draw people in, that attract people time and time again to watch his films?
I think it's a blend of things. It's the aesthetic is really powerful, and the dialogues and the actors, it's always superb actors.
Mm-hmm.
And he's managed to do something which is completely different to what has been done over the years. I mean, the Almodóvar films of the 80s have had nothing to do with what was being done then. And his films now, they're always something different.
Yeah.
That always catches our eyes. So that's one really powerful thing. And also, because he's managed to portray Madrid through the years
right.
in a way no one has. So it's sort of a documentary.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of things. But of course, the humor, the dialogue, the truth that you find, everything. There's something that touches you in a way that not many movies do.
I like your idea that his body of work is in some ways a documentary of Madrid. And you really sense that. But as his fans, I guess I would say, we skip around, you know? One minute you're watching something from the 80s, the next minute you're watching something much older, and it's almost like a timeless experience or a time-free experience watching his movies. You get to really explore human character as it develops through his films, and I think it's really incredible.
It is, because despite the obvious style change, which is, it's necessary because time goes by, but despite the obvious changes, there's always one line connecting everything, which is the color, the dialogue, the drama, you know, so that keeps you connected to him and to his style, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you think he gets his inspiration? I mean, this is a conversation that I think, you know, we may all have an opinion on.
Yeah.
Based on what we're seeing in his films. I could make my own sort of guesses, but from your standpoint, from your experience with his work, where do you think he gets his inspiration?
Well, I'm not the one who should answer this, but obviously all the great movie directors and musicians, boleros, which is the soft Latin music, he's got an array of inspirations, which I don't know, I'm not a scholar, but definitely he's always, I don't know if you say this in English, to wink, to or give a nod.
Yeah.
To classic movies and to different scenes. There's always the ancient Hollywood atmosphere in these films in some shots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge mixture of things and a lot of inspiration of his own, which is great, but I couldn't really say.
I think it's interesting, partially because when you're watching the films, you kind of focus on things that connect with you. And so when I'm watching his films and they show an excerpt from an old Hollywood film, for example, you watch that and you think, oh my gosh, I need to think about this a little bit more deeply because this is one of his references. He's not showing clips, for example, directly from an old Hollywood film for no reason. You have to listen carefully to the dialogue that he selected and raise that up to the time period that he is actually doing the film in and see how it's relevant and why he's chosen that. It's very complex back and forth. When I think of Hitchcock, the beginning of Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown comes to mind.
Yeah.
It feels like classic Hitchcock.
Yeah.
You know, and there's even a scene later in the film that feels like a nod to Hitchcock's Rear Window. And you have to have seen a little bit of Hitchcock to appreciate it. But there's a point where Peppa is standing back and looking at an apartment complex and the different windows of the apartment complex. And she's seeing what's going on in each window. And for me, that's just an absolute link, you know? And then what's funny about that scene is she doesn't just look at the apartment windows. Suddenly she's looking inside a car, which doesn't happen in the Hitchcock film. But she's on a street in Madrid, and this is the version of that happens there for her. And it's something that I think people have that tendency to look in windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's sort of celebrating that, just not just what Hitchcock did in that film as a kind of a voyeuristic tendency of humans.
Yeah.
He pulls it into how does this happen for a regular person, a regular character? You know, you're walking by and you look in a window and someone's dancing. Do you stop and watch that and admire it? Or do you keep walking by? How can you not stop?
Yeah, of course.
Family having a beautiful dinner at a table and it's lit and you're walking by and you see them enjoying a moment. Do you just walk by or do you stop for at least a second and kind of admire the happiness?
Yeah.
And of course, it gets more complex and slightly dark with what may be happening in other windows and that. In addition to Hitchcock, and I'm not sure his other film influences, it would be interesting to do a study on that or read what some, maybe another expert, for example, has written on what his influences are in terms of film. He was also inspired by Pina Bausch, who is not so familiar to modern audiences. And you have a little bit of experience with knowing who she is and even seeing one of her plays, I
she
think.
She was a German choreographer. She was extremely famous, at least in Europe. And when I saw the movie Talk to Her, where there's this Pina Bausch dance, she's doing Kaffee Müller, she's dancing and bouncing against chairs and everything. I love modern dance. And I saw that and I said, wow, I need to see this. And a year or two later, Pina Bausch came to Barcelona with that show. So I bought tickets. They cost me a fortune. I was in like the second row and I managed to see her. There were two shows in one. First, it was Café Müller, which is the one that we see in Almodóvar's film. And then it was The Rite of Spring, which she choreographed, but she didn't dance.
Okay.
And I still think that The Rite of Spring by Pina Bausch is the most amazing and beautiful thing I've seen on stage.
Wow.
And, you know, I was really lucky. It was the month of May, June, and she died 3 months later. So I was really, really lucky to see her. I've seen her, I've seen Pina Bausch company again years later, but I don't know, mm-hmm. it didn't touch me as much as when I saw her on stage that time.
Well, sure. Yeah, I can imagine. And dance is such a beautiful art form. I can see why Pedro Almodóvar is attracted to it as a form of communication.
Yeah.
And you see that actually through his films, the way the characters move and flow through the scenes. It's quite poetic and quite beautiful.
It is. And regarding what you just said before about his movies having this old Hollywood touch,
yeah,
all his movies, all the moves of his actors are sometimes, they seem to be overacted. Yeah. They have this melodramatic thing that the old Hollywood movies had, you know, I mean, when the handsome guy grabbed the lady and there was this close-up,
yeah,
and, you know, the both faces were together. He does that a lot. So dance itself has this, I don't know how to say it in English, but the movements are always, they overact our daily moments. I don't know how to express it, but...
Say it in Spanish.
La sobreactuación, mm-hmm, de las películas de los años 40, 50 también están en el cine de Almodóvar y en la danza. Mm-hmm. Ese movimiento, that exaggerated movement of the body, of the hands,
yes,
you know, which is not natural, but it's beautiful. That you see in the old Hollywood movies, that you see in Almodóvar.
We think about the transition from silent film to the early films he's bringing into his pieces. Early films had to be very physical and movement oriented, and you had to express the story without words. And he does that so beautifully.
Yeah.
That combination and blending of it. Yeah. No, I get
exactly.
It. Can you talk about, aside from Madrid, some of the other towns he's used? Perhaps share what you feel is the significance of some of his choices?
Well, he has portrayed La Mancha, which is all the small towns of his childhood, but mm-hmm, most of them are always story-wise connected because 99% is Madrid. And the truth is, Madrid is a really trendy city, and it's been a really important city over the years, not because it's the capital city, but because the Movida Madrileña took place here.
So this movement that started after the death of Francisco Franco in 1975 really came about in the 80s. I think it would be really helpful if we can understand it a little bit from your perspective, because it plays out in Pedro Almodóvar's films in such a strong way. And it goes back to that honesty that we talked about earlier, that he really takes a look at the real human experience. And I think the movement, at least for me, is a little bit about the truth of what's really happening in people's lives, as opposed to the superficial version that we share with each other. So there's a lot of social expectations and how we behave, and that all shifted during this time. Can you give us your take on the movement and maybe connect it to how Pedro Almodóvar has embraced that with his films?
Well, until 1975, Spain was under 40 years of dictatorship. So when Franco, who was the dictator, when he died and democracy came, mm-hmm, there suddenly was this burst of creativity. And because Spain was, of course, under a dictatorship, but also under a very, very strong censorship. I mean, the Charles Chaplin's movie, The Great Dictator, mm-hmm, hadn't been shown in Spain. And premiere, for example. Most of the poets' books from García Lorca, Machado, from 1920s, 30s, they were all banned and had to be published in Argentina. So that was the thing. I mean, and there were fascists still after Franco, mm-hmm, died that went around with guns and killed people. Yeah. So it was some hard times. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, when democracy comes, when liberty comes, there's a group of teenagers and people who are 20 years old who can finally express themselves. And there was this humongous movement called La Movida. La Movida is a movement, but also in Spanish, when we say que movida, we also mean what a mess. Vaya movida, what a mess. You know, so, mm-hmm, La Movida was also the big mess. The big thing. So among the many creators, which were really great singers and writers, mm-hmm, and poets and movie directors, was Pedro Almodóvar. That's why his first movies are so weird. You know, right, there's a woman pissing on someone's face, and there's drug users, because there were drug addicts, you know, and drugs freed your mind. There was no one knew about, of course, about AIDS. No one knew the the effects of heroin or cocaine. Mm-hmm. They did not. It was something fun. It was absolute freedom. That's what his movies portray. And he was part of that. But he portrayed that with a very personal view, mm-hmm. with a very personal color and dialogue, as we've said before. That's what has made him be an icon and not just a trendy thing.
And I think if you look at women on the verge of a nervous breakdown, you get some very basic examples of that, where you see even by people who you would normally think would not use drugs. For example, there's a lot of sleep medication, or they're putting barbiturates in the gazpacho, yeah. You know, it's like causing everyone to go to sleep. And it's sort of a soft introduction to what was going on during that time. He makes it a little bit funny, but there was also a very sad part of that with the AIDS epidemic. But you see that with Penelope Cruz, where she has AIDS as she's a nun in, what movie am I thinking of? About My Mother?
Yes.
See. And About My Mother, for example, she's a nun who has intercourse and gets pregnant by a transvestite, and then she ends up with AIDS. And, you know, it's interesting because if we think back, those of us that were adults or young adults in the early 80s, these topics were not talked about at all at that time. It was all very new, and AIDS was very isolated, and there was a lot of change that needed to happen to help understand what was going on with the epidemic. And so for him to have touched on that in that film at that time is quite interesting, because it was a very taboo topic at the early stages, and he addressed it in such an interesting way.
And Matador, you know? Matador was a movie from the late 80s with Antonio Banderas, where he has a gay relationship. I mean, that was outrageous, right? Despite this outburst of creativity, of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a movie with gay sexual relationships, just imagine 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's something regarding what you just said about Penelope Cruz. He's now, those movies that look back at the 80s are more melancholic than joyful. Yeah. They talk about the B side of the drugs, of the free relationships. You know, they have this sort of sad part.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't shy away from the dark side of it all. And I think it illuminates what that life was really like. He really takes you in that film down to the dregs of society, where you're on the road looking at what's happening and being experienced by the people involved in that scene. It's pretty dark.
And there's this movie called ¿Qué he hecho yo para merecer esto? What have I done to deserve this?
Yeah.
And he shot it right when La Movida was going on. And it's a movie about a really humble woman in really humble homes, you know, in really low-class homes. So he didn't settle for the good vibes. He didn't film the happiness.
Mm-hmm.
He also wanted to film the sadness and
and
those on the other side of the road, because Madrid has this huge, so to say, stitch, which is M30, which is a big highway that divides the city. And downtown Madrid is on the left side of the M30 of the highway. And this movie, What Have You Done to Deserve It, is shot on the right side of the M30. As to say, you know, there's the happy Madrid, and there's the other part of Madrid where people wake up early and go to work for a really low wage,
mm-hmm.
and are beaten by their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
No, and that he shot in the middle of La Movida, which was very dare and bold. And it's an excellent movie, of course.
And it's back to your point about his body of work being a documentary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which it truly is. In addition to exploring life in Madrid, Almodóvar often returns to rural towns outside of Madrid. And we've talked about that a little bit, but I don't think we've really shared it in a way that people can truly appreciate. He's taking us to these rural towns and giving us an opportunity to really experience life there. Everything from just being inside the living rooms and seeing how they're decorated, to the family dynamics and the complexity of those family dynamics, and how those families interact with their relatives who are also in the same town many times, who don't move away. Some of the secrets that are held between families, all of that. Can you talk about why you think it's important to him to kind of go to these towns and share these stories? Like, for you, what does that do for you when you're in a film, for example, with him, and you're seeing that small town experience?
Well,
how do you take that?
I love it, and knowing Almodovar, it brings you much closer to him because you get to understand where he comes from, and you get to see not only your city, but how other people live. Yeah. I really like it. As I said, it's a documentary on life itself, not only on Madrid, which would be the easy thing to do, you know, just focus on the nice buildings, on the nightlife and movida and such. I really like how it balances with the movies, with the colorful and beautiful part of the movies. And I think it's beautiful too, of course, to know about the villages. And in Spain, we're very connected to the pueblos. That's how we call it. It's not a village itself, it's a pueblo, which okay. is a deeper thing, so to say, because it's where our great-grandfathers came from, and from the mm-hmm. hard work and their traditions. So watching that in a movie is like watching our own roots, our okay. own ancestors, our own family, which is really nice, mm-hmm. and really nice, or really mm-hmm. touching, so to say.
So speaking of life in the smaller towns, I wanted to tell you that one of the things I love about Almodovar's style is the simplicity, yet the depth of his work. And one of my favorite scenes is in Volver, when Raimunda, played by Penelope Cruz, walks uphill on a village road after making the spontaneous decision to take over her friend's bar for the night. And her plan is she's going to serve dinner to a film crew. As she's walking up the hill, she sees various neighbors, and nonchalantly, she asks them what they have in their kitchens, in their homes, that she can buy off of them to use for this dinner. As she's doing that, though, the brief conversation she has with everyone she's talking to is her sister, her aunt, her grandmother. Even though she's not related to them, you feel this very familial connection, and everyone is willing to help her out. It seems normal, for example, that she's shopping from her neighbor's pantries and even offhandedly telling them how to live their lives, as she does with one neighbor who says she would benefit from selling her the dessert she has at home because she could eat a little less. When I heard that, I was like, wow, I cannot believe she just said that to that neighbor. But that's actually how people talk to each other.
Well, that scene, that movie was shot in Vallecas. Vallecas is a working class neighborhood. And, well, of course, it's a movie. But truth is that people in the barrio, they help each other a lot. It's quite something. That's what I like about Madrid. That's why people like their barrio. It's something that when one sees all these shows or American movies, or when someone speaks to an American and, mm-hmm. and that American says, well, I'm leaving home, I'm going to this city 30 hours away, and I'm living abroad and I'm working somewhere else. For us, it's so hard. And people, they want to live in their barrio with their people, with their friends, because it's a kind of a family. And that's very typical in Spain. That's very common. And in Madrid, despite being a huge city, it still feels like that in many places.
What is one of your favorite scenes from Pedro Almodóvar's
movie? Well, as I said, I like Café Müller by Pina Bausch, which I saw in Barcelona. I love all the dialogues of Women at the Verge of an Ebro's breakdown. There's a scene in La Flor de Mi Secreto where they're walking downtown Madrid at night, which everything's empty and clean and beautiful. I usually like all the night scenes of Madrid. I love that because Madrid at night, when it's clean and it's calm, it's such a beautiful city. So it really gives me peace of mind to see it.
Yeah. One of the scenes you brought up in your book is going out to the plaza with Carmen La Mancha in the morning to film. And you talk about how the crew showed up to film when it was, like you said, quiet and calm. But what they found was something that was set up that they didn't want as part of the film. And then Carmen La Mancha, they have her destroy it.
Yeah, she burned it. Yeah.
She burned it.
It was Almodóvar. He didn't like the set, the backdrop, so he burned it. What I did in the book in El Madrid de Almodóvar was I not only say where it was shot or the tapas or the flamenco or the joints that are around, but I also tell anecdotes on the places. And going back to Vallecas, which is the neighborhood where Volver was shot, the scene that you told me, you know, Penelope Cruz walking with vegetables and setting up a restaurant. There's a funny scene that the restaurant that she works at, it's a backdrop, it's a set. Uh-huh. And the people around, they thought it was real. And the Coca-Cola truck went there, you know, to deliver Cokes. And they said, well, no, I mean, it's just set up for the movie and we're going to tear it down tomorrow. One of the anecdotes was, I was telling you before that I had some hard times sometimes knowing where a scene was shot, because I asked Pedro Almodóvar's team, but it's not that easy to talk to them and to get information, you know? I understand, because there are so many films, so many locations. They have helped me sometimes, but not always. And in Vallecas, I had no way of knowing where that scene was shot. And I saw Penelope Cruz walking briefly, and I saw this street sign saying Pico Peña Golosa for a small second. And my best friend lives there.
Oh, wow.
And it was like a flash. And I called him and I said, hey, I'm doing this book on Almodóvar. Do you know if he shot there? And I said, yeah, it was such a mess. We couldn't park. We couldn't go shopping. So
the
one place I just couldn't find where it was shot, my best friend was living there. So he gave me all of the information and all the places that appear in the movie. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to get to that part in the book. So far, I've read through Malasaña, and it's just a fun exploration to go through and see what you found out about and written about. Some of Almodóvar's most frequent Madrid locations include the Cemetery of La Almudena, the Madrid airport. He also frequently used the Plaza Mayor and Puerta de Alcalá and the Ave station at Atocha. What stands out to you as his most iconic Madrid backdrops?
For the people in Madrid, the building in Gran Vía, it's really important. It's a building that has the word metropolis on top, and there has this winged god sculpture.
Oh, yeah.
And Penelope Cruz, she's giving birth inside a bus, and she starts to shout, the angel is falling down.
Oh.
And, you know, it's this beautiful building. It's right on the corner between Calle Alcalá and Calle Gran Vía. The most iconic scenes by Almodóvar have been shot around that area. And it's beautiful building, beautiful place to walk around. Mm-hmm. That's really, really, really iconic. Mm-hmm. And also the Rastro, the flea market, is shot several times there. But there was this very famous bar called La Bobia. I mean, mm-hmm. Madrid's filled with bars, but for one reason or another, everyone in the 80s, they went to have a beer at La Bobia, which is a small bar. So it was like a routine that 99% of the people did. They went to the flea market on Sundays. They walked around and they had a beer at this place. And there's a scene that takes place in that bar. And to me, it's iconic, not only because of the time period, but because I did that as a child with my mother. So, you know, it brings me really nice childhood memories.
I think it's interesting to talk about that building, because you see that angel occur in another film, The Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, when she's looking over the balcony, right? It's right there on the right in that scene. And that's actually somewhere I would love to go and see from that perspective, just because that's such an iconic scene, at least for me. Yeah, you recommend going to the principal Madrid hotel to see that, right?
Yeah, they're very nice. When the book was out back in 2017, they were extremely kind and they opened the doors. And I've had several interviews with Mexican television, with Spanish media on their balconies. So you can see that same shot. But truth is that shot was a backdrop. It's not real. It was a painting. So what he's done is, if you stand out on the balcony, what you will see is, if you have this really wide view, you'll have all the buildings that one sees in the film. But what he's done is he's packed them all together so as to have them fit on the screen. But truth is that they are not packed together.
Well, that's an interesting fact.
Yeah. But in the past just 5-6 years, there's really three amazing places that you have to visit when you're downtown Madrid. One is Principal Hotel, and you go upstairs and you don't have to get a room or nothing. You know, there's this small cafeteria. So you just go upstairs and you can see that same views, or the real views where he inspired himself. And also right in front, Bellas Artes, where most of his movies are made. It has an amazing rooftop where you can have incredible views. It's right on the other side of the street where Hotel Principal is, and okay. also on the Madrid townhouse where Cibeles is. It has another humongous and beautiful rooftop. So you can have really, really, really great views on that area, and you can see everything that Almodóvar has shot, just walking two blocks around.
I think it would be fun to go up there and try to identify the buildings as you scan the city and try to put it together in your mind, because that view in that particular film is so iconic.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to me to go up there and figure out where those buildings actually are. Well, Sasha, your book not only celebrates Almodóvar's Madrid, it also celebrates your Madrid. By reading it, we learn page by page what you love about the city. And it's beautiful to see what you've written about the transformations of certain neighborhoods like Chueca. Can you tell us a little bit about your take on the changes in that area, the transformation that neighborhood has seen over the years?
Well, Chueca was a barrio downtown Madrid, and it was really impoverished and filled with drug addicts and prostitutes. And there were many, many gay bars as well back in the 80s, which mm-hmm. in the movie Atame, Time Me Up, Time Me Down, mm-hmm. you can see Antonio Banderas, he goes there and he wants to buy drugs and the places. Mm-hmm. It's falling apart. That's what Chueca was. And in a matter of, 5 to 10 years, there was a 180 degrees change. The gate started to build up a community and to change it slowly. And they changed it up to a point where the barrio stopped being a ghetto and became a trendy place, and where people cared for their homes, and it was not slums, it was not clubs, and they slowly changed it. And it's now a really trendy place, and it's extremely expensive to live there. And it's where everyone goes and walks and goes to have cerveza and beer in the evening. So yeah, it's changed a lot. And I've lived in Chueca. I've lived in a place where Almodóvar shot a movie about nuns that have a tiger as a pet. It's a really bizarre movie from the 80s, really weird. And they're living in this rundown building. Well, the building when Chueca was a ghetto was falling apart, and they turned that building into really fancy lofts, like New York lofts. And I lived in one of the lofts, so I was right there. I lived there.
Wait a minute, this place looks familiar.
Yeah.
As I was reading the book, I found it really funny to see the difference in the way you describe what you love about Madrid versus what you recommend people stay away from. Two excerpts that I wanted to read for our listeners, but I needed some help on a word. What does de anodina mean?
Anodina, it's something that it's that you wouldn't even think about stopping by, that has no interest at all. Innocuous. Okay.
Okay. So the first excerpt that I wanted to read from your book, I've translated it into the best English that I can. And this is something where we learn what you love about the city. So it's about Malasaña, and you write, at the back of the Museum of History, at number 13, is an innocuous palace, is that what you would say?
Yep.
An innocuous palace named San Mateo. It was built in the 18th century, and there you'll find the Museum of Romanticism. You wrote, we will not talk about the collection of historical objects or the art central to daily life, or the costumes from the 19th century, but rather a small garden that few know of, where you will find a pleasant and, of course, romantic cafe where you can have breakfast, brunch, or try some of their tarts.
Yep.
And I think that's just a sweet look into what you offer us to kind of inspire us to go, but also help us to understand, just a little piece of something you love. And then to contrast that, I continued reading and I just started laughing out loud when I read about something that you don't recommend we do.
Yeah.
I translated that also in Malasaña. You write about a tavern, and you can help me with the translation if I've done anything incorrectly here, but here's my translation of it. The tavern of Angel Sierra, is that right?
Yeah.
Is a cerveceria, or what I would call, I think, a pub or a tavern.
Yeah, but a pub in Spain, a pub is more a sort of an Irish sort of pub, with leather seats and stools and that. But in Spain, a bar is really a place with a lot of light and life, and it's not the gloomy kind of pub.
Okay, so all right, so we'll call it a cerveceria with a different definition than.
Yeah, it's sort of a cafeteria, so to say.
Okay, I see. And so in this, you say the tavern of Angel Sierra is a cerveceria whose bar overlooks the street La Calle Gavina,
yep.
Which you can access from San Gregorio. And there is a small salon, or what I would call a living room,
yep,
that until recently was reserved only for friends of the owner, which sounds so Spanish that he would only have his friends there. But what you write cracked me up. I was just reading along thinking I was going to hear something nice about this tavern, but you said the following. Today, the tavern is known for the worst service with unpleasant waiters. And you wrote, y de perpetuo mal gesto, which is bad gestures or something?
They're always frowning.
Oh, frowning. Okay.
Yeah.
And abominable tapas that include rancid jamón serrano served in a pan mold.
No, pan mold is in a sandwich bread.
Oh, sandwich bread. Okay.
Instead of a baguette or some sort of bread like that. Well, thing is that, by the way, in Angel Sierra, which Almodóvar shows in many of his movies, when the singer Mick Jagger came to Madrid 2-3 months ago for a concert, he took a picture of himself having a cerveza, a beer, right there. You know, it's in the center of Chueca, and there's a lot of people there, but I mean, I've lived there. And the thing about the bares of Madrid are like a happy cafeteria, so to say. And usually you have a beer and you have some tapas, you know. But this place, it's awful. I mean, but people go there, you know, because they're just in Chueca and they say, well, this is a great place. Let's go there. So what I wanted to do with El Madrid Almodóvar was I just wanted to walk people around hand in hand. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Just not a guide of this is Madrid, just find your way out. No, I just wanted to say, hey, look, you're a friend of mine. This is where I have my tapas. Don't go there by any chance. They shot a movie, okay, but don't go there by any chance because this is hideous. And there's many places like that, not awful places, but in the style of Angel Sierra, because in Madrid there were, back in the 40s, 50s, and before, it was very common for wine dealers to bring their wines to Madrid, and they had their own stores to sell wine. So they brought wine and they served wine, and there was this small salon or small hall behind where the owner did business with the sellers, or where he met with people, you know. That's
right.
And it's a really special structure that some places still keep up today, but of course open to everyone.
Interesting.
There's some really nice places like that.
Well, I love that you wrote at the end of that description, definitivamente un lugar a evitar.
Yeah.
Which is definitely a place to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to find out a little bit about how your book gets updated. Can you share that with us?
Sure. When I finished my book back in 2015, 2016, I was very happy with the result. And then Almodóvar came up with a new movie. So I said, okay, I have to update it.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I was going to print it, then he came up with another movie. So I said, okay, this is never ending. There's no way I'm going to print this ever. And that's the humongous problem that another guide, which is also about the locations that Almodóvar has used, has had, that once it's published, it immediately becomes outdated. What I did was I published it with Amazon.
Uh-huh.
I had several offers from publishing companies, but I didn't want that because Amazon gives me something absolutely amazing. Amazon has this service where you can upload your Word file and the book will be in the cloud. And when someone orders a book, Amazon will print it, bound it, and ship it in 48 hours. So if Almodóvar makes a new movie today, then I will watch the movie right tonight. I will change my book and we'll upload it. So in 3 hours' time, you will have a new book. And whichever book you have, you will always have the latest book with the latest restaurant, the latest schedules, the latest movies, everything.
That's incredible.
I do the same with the Kindle book. But the Kindle book, it's much better because all of the addresses and locations I give have this link to Google. So if you just want to go somewhere to just grab your iPad or your iPhone and you click on the address and it takes you there. So it's much better to watch it on Kindle. As far as I know, it's the only guide that's updated 24 hours and that it will always, always be updated.
I can't wait to get it on my phone and walk through Madrid and just click on some of, I mean, it just seems like such modern technology.
I couldn't believe it myself.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, before we go, I wanted to mention that in addition to this book, you are also a children's writer, and that anyone looking for children's books in Spanish can look up your most recent book, which is you're going to love my pronunciation. I'll do my best. La Increíble Aventura de Jack y el Zoo Abandonado.
Yep.
How'd I do?
You did perfect. Really well.
You can read it on, you can order it. It takes a little bit of time to get from Spain and it's slightly more costly to ship it to the US where I am, for example, but you can also read it on Kindle, which is great. I actually personally love to read children's books as I'm studying Spanish. So I actually have read quite a bit of Roald Dahl's books or all of his books in Spanish, which I understand is one of your influences. What is your most recent book, and can you tell us a little bit about the story and what inspired you to write it?
Well, my biggest inspiration is my two kids. I'm a father of two, a 12-year-old boy and a 10-year-old girl, and they are my audience, and I don't mind if they're the only ones reading me. I just write because I love reading them, reading books. And so that's my biggest inspiration. And, you know, I just, when I finished reading all Roald Dahl books to them, I said, wow, I wish there were more books. But so I said, okay, I'll write them myself. And I love how he writes. I love his style. My latest book is Jack y el Zoo Abandonado, Jack and the Abandoned Zoo. It's a story about a kid that finds out that he can talk with the animals. And the zoo he lives, because he's the zookeeper's son, the zoo he lives in, it's falling apart. So since he finds out that he can talk with the animals, he stages a plan to save the zoo. That's, so to say, that's a very short way to explain it, but there's many stories going around. And then there's another book called La Pandilla Canica, the Canica Gang, and where the key element is a teenage girl who's an inventor, and she solves everything doing weird inventions, and she saves the day doing really weird inventions, which one can learn how to do, because at the end of the book, there's this big guide of all the inventions she's done. It's not Hollywood inventions, but really homemade, funny tricks.
Oh my God, that's so great. Yeah. I love it. And in this era of more kids are doing school from home and what we saw with COVID, I think having this book and kind of fun projects to do, unique projects to do, inspired by a book, is such a full experience of reading and participating and doing something on your own. How great. Can you tell us a little bit about your sweet book, My Grandpa is a Star?
Well, My Grandpa is a Star is a children's book, ages 3 to 6. It was my first book. Back in 2015, when my kids were 4 and 2, I was told that their grandmother, who was only 60 years old, and my great-grandfather, whom they were very close to, they told me they were both very ill. So I just wondered, how was I going to explain what death is to two little kids? Was I going to talk about heaven, hell? Was this okay? In the sense that, will they understand what heaven is? So I just came up with an idea, which is that grandma and great grandpa would become stars. So when they died, which they died in just a couple months later, both of them at almost the same time, I came up to my 4-year-old son with this with a cardboard kitchen paper, you know, the kitchen, the tube inside the kitchen paper. I just took it out and I gave it to him like as if it were something really important. And he said, "Kid, grandpa just died." He was bursting in tears. So I gave it to him and said, "This is your telescope. You can paint it and it's your telescope." So, you know, his mind totally changed and he suddenly became really optimistic and he painted his telescope and he went outside on the street and he watched the stars and he said, "Well, the star that shines the most, that's your great grandfather." And he started shouting at him, and it was a beautiful story. Yeah, so I wrote down that story and I sent it to friends of mine and said, "Hey, you have to send this to a publishing company," which I did, and they published it, and it worked really well.
Well, what has been some of your favorite feedback from your young readers and their families?
Just the fact of them coming to ask me to sign their books, it's such a humongous experience, and I really love it. I really love to read stories to them. I've been going to bookstores and toy stores to paint telescopes with them. You know, I gather all these cardboard tubes all through the year. So when my publishing company asks me to go and sign books or to read young children's books, I always bring a lot of cardboard tubes. And so I read them Grandpa's a Star, I read them whatever book it is, but we always end up painting telescopes. And it's a joyful experience. It is a really joyful experience.
That's incredible. Well, are you working on a new book or are you taking a break?
I'm writing a new book, the fourth book of La Pandilla Canica, of this inventor's gang. I'm always writing and I can't stop really.
That's awesome. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us here today. This has been such a terrific conversation.
Thanks so much, Molly. Thanks for inviting me to your podcast. It's been a joy to talk to you, and I hope to see you in Spain and to show you around.
I would love that. I would love that. Thank you so much. I will include links to your books in my blog post about our chat today, and you can find that post at www.nextflighttospain.com with the number 2 instead of the word T-O. In the meantime, you can order his books on Amazon and Kindle. As I said before, it costs a little extra to have them shipped from Spain, but I think it's well worth it. And for our listeners, I hope we've given you fresh ideas for enjoying Spain on your next trip. I've enjoyed being your host here at Next Flight to Spain. Subscribe to my blog at www.nextflighttospain.com with the number 2 instead of the word T-O. I'll let you know when my next episode is coming out. And until then, salud!